AgriTalk is brought to you by Full Scale from Helena. Grow strong returns this season with breakthrough foliar nutrition from Full Scale at Reproduction. This AgriTalk podcast is brought to you by Acuron corn herbicide from Syngenta, which delivers 5 to 15 more bushels an acre than any other herbicide. Acuron is a restricted-use pesticide. Acuron Yield Advantage range is based on 2016 Syngenta and university trials. You probably already know that there are currently over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage. If you're a farmer, that gives you over 2 billion really good reasons to tell your legislators and friends to support ethanol. Learn more at poet.com/ag. EPA missed another deadline. We'll find out why on today's show. And we'll take a look at what's happened to farm income since the arrival of COVID-19. We know that grain prices have rallied. But has it turned into more income?
Live from the dawn of December via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning we welcome John Newton, Chief Economist from the American Farm Bureau Federation. Then it's Emily Score from Growth Energy. And right after the news, Annalisa Laca from Farm Journal's Milk. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson, and now the host of AgriTalk, Chip Flory.
And December is starting with a beautiful day here in Northeast Iowa. No question about that. A little chilly. I'll give you that. But It's gorgeous out there.
It is. Really good. This is becoming a regular thing. Frost on the ground. You know, first thing this morning.
Yeah.
I guess... It almost sounds like that might be the closest thing we get to a white Christmas.
It's starting to look that way. And the listeners out east, Ohio, Pennsylvania, into New York, my goodness, it looks like they're going to be getting a bunch of snow. Even down into North Carolina, they're going to be getting some snow. Yes, absolutely.
Oh, boy. Stay off the sidewalks in North Carolina.
That's right. Yep. They forget how to drive in the snow very quickly. It's a little
I'm beginning to wonder if I even remember how to drive in the snow. I don't know.
That's right.
I may have forgotten.
Yep. We've got a good show this morning. I'm really looking forward to this. John Newton's going to be stopping by. We're going to talk about what's going on in his world. I know that he's done some comparisons of how the ag markets responded initially to COVID-19 and where we stand now, in contrast to that initial reaction to COVID-19. I want to talk to him about that. And then we'll talk with Emily Score from Growth Energy about EPA missing a deadline on the RVOs. What's next? What are we waiting for on this? And then I want to see what Emily is expecting from the Biden administration and how Growth Energy might be gearing up for the change in the administration. So looking forward to that. All right, man. Let's get to it. What you got in the news?
Well, Chip, global debt is on track to hit $277 trillion by year's end. That's a record 365% of world gross domestic product. The enormoid sums reflect actions of the Fed and other central banks in response to the pandemic, which slashed interest rates and brought trillions of dollars to fixed income securities, helping borrowers ride out the economic peril. Fed Chair Jerome Powell told lawmakers that stimulus money helped maintain household spending, noting that nearly half of the pandemic-related job losses have been recovered, but Powell continued to warn of great uncertainties ahead. And you know, I don't know how long that stimulus money really held out.
Well,
is the thing.
Yeah, that is definitely
at least to the average citizen. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah, kind of got us to July 1 in many cases, and since then, a lot of these people have been without income, have been without. Support, and that's why you see some of these food lines, and you know, we talked about it over Thanksgiving, you know, with that. Mm-hmm. Hey, I'm thankful that I'm not in a food line picking up Thanksgiving dinner. In other words, I'm thankful that we still get to show up to work. And somebody mentioned, you know, but I wonder about those food lines because look at some of the cars that they're driving. Well, yeah, they're still having to make a car payment, too, but they don't have a job to go to.
Yeah, that's the thing. They got to drive their car now because they're 2 months behind on the payments. Yeah,
it's frightening, man. It really is.
Well, China has accused American officials of harassing airline and shipping crews arriving in the U.S. China says U.S. law enforcement personnel had recently boarded 21 ships owned by state-owned Costco Shipping Holdings and Shanghai Zhenhua Heavy Industries after they berthed in the U.S. and questioned them extensively about Communist Party membership and their links with the Chinese government. Chip, I don't know. These seem like legitimate questions.
And it could be harassment too. I don't know.
I suppose
the thing is, if they are pointing to it, they are more than likely going to retaliate for it at some point. It's a setup. It's a setup for further action for tit for tat.
There you go.
Trade policy.
Well, as Washington speculation grows about who will be in the cabinet for a Biden administration, current California Air Resources Board Chair Mary Nichols has been mentioned as a possible choice to become EPA administrator. Nichols has existing ties with Kamala Harris and served EPA from 1993 to 1997 as the head of the Office of Air and Radiation. The 75-year-old Nichols was quoted as saying, if they offer me the job, I would take it, Chip.
Okay. Yeah, we'll find out from Emily Score what she thinks about Nichols and the possibility of her becoming EPA administrator. I don't know if it's a certainty, but I'm not hearing any other names right now.
All right. Quickly, OPEC says it will wait until later this week before deciding whether or not to extend mandated oil production cuts among its members. This as ExxonMobil says it will write off $20 billion in natural gas and exploration investment, forecasting a 15% slide in its workforce by the end of 2021. And finally, China's ruling Communist Party wants to significantly expand the number of middle-income earners by 2035. South China Morning Post notes, quote, China must increase its middle class to avoid the middle income trap where a developing country's growth stagnates because of structural obstacles that impede development. Did they really call themselves a developing country? I mean, come on.
Well, so does the World Trade Organization. That's part of the problem.
If
you're not developed after 6,000 years,
right?
what are we waiting for? I mean, it's the world's second largest economy, for criminy's sake.
Don't get me started.
Get
me out of here.
Good stuff. Thank you, Davis. Let's bring in Annalisa Laca, editor of Farm Journal's Milk. How are you this morning, Annalisa?
I'm doing great. How are you, Chip?
Good, good, good. So what's the latest on this letter from Dean Foods?
So the latest, and, you know, what's funny is you're having John Newton on today, and he and I are going to connect on this today later, too. Because there is some information that we need farmers who receive this letter to know. One of those is that this is not a scam and that they need to take care of it. I know that sounds silly to have to say, but I think farmers were so blindsided by receiving this that it does feel like maybe this is wrong and this, you know, it's fishy is what farmers are telling me. It is not fishy. This is very normal. Fortunately, most farmers will be able to fight these claims. We talked to Roger McEwen of Washburn University yesterday, and he advises farmers to get a qualified bankruptcy attorney that can help you fight this, and that because these transactions occur during what's called the normal course of business, they'll be able to get out of paying this. So he's calling these extortion letters. Basically, Dean Foods is, you know, the trustees are trying to see how much money they can get back to help pay off the debt that they have. But the bottom line is get an attorney, find all of your statements from that period of time for shipping that milk and being paid for it, and then, you know, respond to this letter.
Okay. All right. Very good. Hey, Annalisa, John's up next. If you want to stick around, if you've got time, feel free to stick around for the conversation, and we'll talk with John about it, too. The other thing that I want to talk with John about is the dairy margin coverage. Make sure that that people get signed up for that.
Okay, great.
All right, excellent. Annalisa Locke is going to stick around for a conversation with John Newton coming up next. All right, John is the chief economist at American Farm Bureau Federation. Corn herbicides are only as good as their active ingredient, or AI, components, and some are better than others. I'm joined today by Steve Gomm. He is the corn herbicide product lead with Syngenta. Steve, what consideration should growers make when they are choosing their next corn herbicide?
Sure. First and foremost, consider that not all herbicides provide the same level of value. And while input cost is definitely a factor, growers should think about the spectrum of weeds they need to control, the length of residual they need, the application flexibility based on their program, and then certainly the potential return on investment is important as well.
I love that ROI. Does it pay to go premium?
Well, cheaper options may lack thorough testing and company backing, Chip, and can be made up of older technologies where some weeds may have already developed resistance to. Bicyclopyrone is a Syngenta exclusive AI for Acuron corn herbicide, which has been tested in more than 1,000 trials and proven to provide built-in burn down, greater consistency, powerful weed control, and the longest lasting residual, all with proven crop safety.
Okay, this is interesting, and I'm going to try to say it. Bicyclopyrone, what makes it so special?
Well, let me use this analogy. In every sport, okay, there's an MVP, someone who not only performs great on their own, but also raises the level of performance of those around them. Bicyclopyrone is our MVP in Acuron. When it's combined with the other active ingredients, there's three of them, it just delivers a higher level of weed control more consistently with multiple effective sites of action. And better weed control means more sunlight, nutrients, and water are available for the growing corn crop, which for Acuron leads to higher yield potential, 5 to 15 more bushels an acre than any other herbicide.
All right. Good stuff. Thank you so much, Steve. That was Steve Gomm. He is the corn herbicide product lead with Syngenta, talking to us about the value of bicyclopyrone and what it brings to Acuron and why this effective weed control is so important. To find out what an extra 5 to 15 bushels per acre with Acuron corn herbicide could mean for your revenue potential, try Syngenta's online calculator at findmorebushels.com or talk to your local Syngenta retailer. Acuron is a restricted-use pesticide. Acuron yield advantage range is based on 2016 Syngenta and university trials.
Right now, there are over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage, waiting to solve the world's most pressing issues, like climate change. But exports are unreliable and have been flat for 30 years. So how do we utilize all that corn while ensuring dependable markets right here at home? POET is working hard to increase the amount of ethanol in the nation's fuel supply from 10 to 15%. Nationwide, adoption of E15 would generate almost 2 billion bushels of new corn demand each year, which is the equivalent of nearly doubling corn exports by increasing domestic markets that can't be taken away. That's 2 billion really good reasons to tell your legislators and friends to support higher blends of ethanol. It's time for farmers to unite around E15. Biofuels like ethanol are the key to successful agriculture, and successful agriculture will change the world. Learn more about what you can do to support nationwide E15 at poet.com/ag.
Hey.
America's conservation ag movement would like to recognize the Nature Conservancy for its efforts to help farmers build healthier soils and a more resilient agriculture system. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM.
Say, Chip.
And yes, Davis.
Yeah. You know, if I did get that call back from Liv Tyler, I'd probably take her to see Justin Timberlake.
Would you?
I think I would, yeah. I think that'd be a good first date for Liv Tyler.
I think
second date,
too.
I have no idea. I mean, after that, I'm out of ammo, basically.
I got you. I got you. Well, but at least you got plans for the first one.
Sure. You know, we'll see where it goes from there.
You can figure it out later.
Yeah.
All right. Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm Chip. That's Davis. Annalisa Laca, the editor of Farm Journal's Milk, is sticking with us here. Welcome back, Annalisa. And we've got John Newton, who is the chief economist for the American Farm Bureau Federation, with us as well. John, I know it's a busy morning for you. Thank you so much for making time.
No, I appreciate your all's flexibility.
Yeah, no worries, man, no worries. Like I said, John, Annalisa Laca is with us on the line, and she was just talking about the letter from Dean Foods, and Annalisa was explaining that it's standard operating procedure, but what should farmers do when they get this letter, John?
Well, first and foremost, I'm not a lawyer, so this is not legal advice, but
right.
I guarantee you, when you read the defense in the letter, that these farmers have a full or nearby close to full defense that would relieve them of paying these monies. So I would advise any farmer that got one of these letters, contact a bankruptcy attorney. We're all over it. We've got outside counsel that we're working on at Farm Bureau. We've just had a conversation with USDA. That's why I had to push this call back just a couple minutes. We represent farms across the country. And when we started getting reports of this happening over the weekend, you know, we did what we do. We activated our grassroots. We got our legal counsel on top of this, and we're working hard and fast. You know, this is a predatory practice by these folks. It's not fair to these farmers to get a letter over Thanksgiving saying you owe all this money. You don't know what to do. And for some of these folks, it's the last straw. So, that you know, we're going to work. The challenge now is getting the information out fast enough so that some family doesn't mess around and send in a check that they may not be able to get back. This law firm needs to withdraw this letter. There needs to be a cease and desist. But again, I'm not a lawyer. We've hired some experts to help us make the right steps here.
Gotcha. Annalisa, what else are you hearing from farmers about this?
Well, one of the things that, to John's point, that, you know, it's unfortunate about the way that these letters were written and distributed is that, you know, they're very intimidating. There's a deadline of December 19th. It says in the letter, you know, that if you don't pay this by this point, then we have the right to sue you, which, you know, the lawyer that I talked to yesterday said that that's actually true, that they, you know, that farmers should fight this, but that they could potentially be sued, not to say that the you know, Dean Foods trustees would win that lawsuit, but there's the potential for that. And the other thing is that was frustrating for the farmers that received this is that, you know, when they reached out to their local field reps, their DFA field reps for most of them now, the field reps didn't have any information. So I did talk to DFA yesterday, and they are also going to arm their field reps with information about what farmers should do about this. So I think, you know, to John's point, the more that we can help farmers understand the next steps, the better off everyone will be.
John, should farmers be lawyering? Should they get a lawyer for this?
I wouldn't make any payment until you've consulted a lawyer. You know, we've got outside counsel, so we're going to get this situated. We're gonna you know, reach out to this law firm. You know, they ask for you to defend this, to give invoices of milk that you may have shipped to you know, Southern Foods LLC during this period. They've got that information. So why they're asking farm families to sit at their table and make an Excel spreadsheet to defend what was an ordinary business transaction is beyond me. But again, we've got lawyers. I don't want to get ahead of where the lawyers are going to tell us to be on this. But, you know, we've heard from states across the country of farmers who got these letters. And we're working on it. I've got a call later this morning on this very issue. President Zippy Duvall is very passionate about this. This isn't the right thing. You shouldn't be doing this to farmers across the country. They've had a tough year already. This is not what you do to people on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that's for sure. So you said that you're at USDA having a meeting on this. Can I ask what the initial reaction there is?
Well, they're going to be digging into it. You know, we had an impromptu meeting with some folks at USDA on a number of issues, and this was one of them. And so they're going to dive into it, and hopefully they can help as well. I think if USDA were to reach out to this law firm, we reach out to this law firm. You know, if they can withdraw this, you know, these predatory letters that they sent to farmers, make sure that farmers have the right legal advice on what the best steps are to proceed. And again, based on, you know, my understanding right now, I think folks are going to have a full or close to full defense of this and not have to pay those large sums of monies that they're being asked to pay.
Good. Okay. We've got a deadline coming up for the DMC, John. What's the math on this? Does it make sense to sign up for DMC?
You know, the challenge is we never know what's going to happen. But, you know, Chairman Peterson, when he made these improvements to DMC in the Farm Bill, made it affordable enough for the first 5 million pounds of milk that it should be a no-brainer. And if, okay. if it triggers, which it looks like it's going to trigger quite a bit in 2021, then you want to have some protection. You know, the dairy market was a tale of two halves this year, folks that had yep. milk going into cheese plants and folks that didn't. And the risk management tools this year didn't work exactly the way folks hoped they would because of these large negative PPDs. But, you know, the Farmers to Food Box program is likely over. The rally in cheese prices that we saw this year has evaporated. You want to put some risk management in place. This is an easy decision to make, in my opinion, is you get in the 950 for at least your first $5 million. And then layer on top of it DRP or you know, any other yep. risk management plan yep. you want to put in place.
Right. The producer price differentials, you mentioned that that they were negative and very frustrating for producers when they see what happened to the futures market, not so much anymore, but what had happened to the futures market, and they weren't realizing those higher prices. Are the PPDs still negative?
Yeah, they were very big negatives in October. A lot of milk has been depooled, taken out of these federal order pools. They're probably going to be negative again in November. But then, like I just said, the air's come out of the cheese market. Class yeah. 3 milk prices in December are you know, what, 16, 15 bucks? So
15,
the PPDs
20.
Are probably, yeah, they're not going to be that negative because, right. you know, there's not a lot of differential between the Class 1 and Class 3 at that point. And what you're likely to see is all that cheese milk try to come running back into the pool now, and that's yeah. you know, that's the other, you know, unfortunate thing that's happened this year is not everybody's seen $25-$30 milk. Some folks are getting gotcha. $15 yep. milk, and it's frustrating.
Yep absolutely. Annalisa, what else are we missing from the dairy market? We got it covered.
Well, you know, the thing I was just going to mention to John is, you know, there's a lot of talk about these negative PPDs pointing to federal order reform, and I know that's something that Farm Bureau has, you know, take an interest in. I'm just curious if there's any update from John there.
You know, we are continuing to work on it. You know, we've got the best grassroots game in town, and our grassroots members are updating our policies around the country as we speak. We look forward to what we see come our December resolutions meeting and then our January voting delegate session to see where we are on updating our policies. But you know, Chip and Anna, the thing we need before all that is we need farmers to have a seat at the table. And right now, the only way that they can cast a ballot on a federal order issue is either through their cooperative block vote or individual farmers can vote. A farmer can't ask to get an individual ballot and vote confidentially. You know, we adopted right. policy a couple years ago for something called modified block voting that lets yep. that farmer say, you know what, I want to cast a ballot on something that impacts, you know, my farm's livelihood. I want to have a voice. I want to have a say. And hopefully we can get that and then sit down and have a conversation on federal order reform. If we don't do that, Chip, I mean, it'll be mm-hmm. – we'll go to a hearing, and then it'll be a decade before we do another hearing, and we'll have half the number of dairy farms left in this country.
Yeah.
So we need to act sooner rather than later in giving these folks a voice.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Great question there, Annalisa. I'm glad you asked that. John, we are out of time, and we haven't even gotten to the what I wanted to talk with you about, and that's how these markets and the farm income potential has changed from pre-COVID to where we are now. I need to get you back on either later this week or early next week, okay?
Where I come from, that's called running it back, Chip. Let's do it.
All right. Sounds good. That is John. Annalisa, thank you so much for jumping in yep. there. And that conversation was with John Newton, Chief Economist for the American Farm Bureau Federation. We've got more AgriTalk coming up next.
There are over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage, waiting to solve the world's most pressing issues, like climate change. Moving from 10 to 15% ethanol nationwide would result in almost 2 billion bushels of new domestic corn demand each year. That means nearly eliminating the need for corn exports by ensuring dependable markets right here at home while driving commodity prices to profitable levels. Biofuels are the key to successful agriculture, and successful agriculture can change the world. Learn more at poet.com/ag.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from ProFarmer.
And joining us now is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Beej, little bit of clawback here from yesterday's losses, but not much.
No, not much, Chip. I think some ideas that yesterday's losses may have been overdone, giving us some support. And really, you look to the outside markets and specifically the dollar, and it's under heavy pressure, dropping to the lowest level since April of 2018 this morning on a downside breakout. So that's probably providing us a little bit of price support in both of those markets. But like you said, the buyer interest is limited so far.
Yeah, that cheap dollar, I mean, is it just more fear over the debt load that we're building here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think both the fundamentals and the technicals now are breaking down, so we're probably headed even lower for the U.S. dollar. But, that should provide us some support. It should be the most supportive for the wheat market and what it means for potentially for exports there. It's pulled the wheat market well off its lows this morning, but they're still under a little bit of price pressure here. And U.S. prices just aren't competitive because when you take into account the freight rate, we're priced out of the market, and the Black Sea region continues to dominate the bulk of that global trade.
Gotcha. Real quick, take us over to livestock. Some positive numbers there.
Cattle market, it's trading to the upside, being helped out by the stock market there. Some, I think, with strength there in the Dow this morning in S&P and maybe some hopes for higher cash cattle trade later on in the week. Front end of the hog market, the December contracts being held back by the fact that it's now at premium to the cash index. And it's been a while since that's been the case, but holding back buyer interest so far.
Yeah, and a little bit of strength in the back month lean hog futures. Thank you, Brian. That is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady on Markets Now.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Dribble Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors. It starts with a plan. That's why America's Conservation Ag Movement is inviting you to get your farm business ready for 2021 with a free resource stewardship planning guide. Get your free guide today at agweb.com/ACAM.
All right, welcome back to AgriTalk. Great conversation with John Newton. Davis steps out of a meeting at USDA and gives us an update on what they were talking about in the meeting. Pretty cool.
And offers to run it back, too.
Yes.
Run it back. It's a new term. I'm going to use that. Yeah, I'm going to use that excessively throughout my day.
Mm-hmm. Good deal. All right, let's bring in Emily Score. Emily is the CEO for Growth Energy, joins us right now. Emily, welcome back to AgriTalk.
Thanks for having me. Good to talk with you again.
You bet. It's great to have you back. Good grief. I mean, it should be no surprise that we didn't get the announcement yesterday because we didn't even get the proposed renewable volume obligations. So it's no surprise we didn't get the final numbers on this, Emily. But what's the holdup?
Well, it's no surprise, but it's incredibly frustrating. And that's why we were sending a letter to EPA today with an intent to sue. We need our 2020 blending obligations. You're absolutely right. The final renewable volume obligations were due yesterday. We didn't even see a pending all summer. I think, for the most part, for these past several months, EPA has been dragging its feet and kicking its can and playing a game of politics. And, enough already. We need some answers and we need some certainty in this marketplace.
Okay. So you said a letter is going out that there's court action to be expected over this?
That's right. So it's the first step is for us, it's a letter of intent to EPA, putting them on notice that because they have failed to fulfill their statutory obligations, we may take legal action.
Okay. There are some out there, Emily, that would argue, doesn't it just make more sense to wait for the Biden administration?
Well, the truth is, even if it comes out and there's a proposal that comes out today, it's still going to be finished in the Biden administration.
Right.
But what's important is we cannot take our foot off the gas. We need the RVOs to come out. So, this letter of intent is our way of saying we still have for the next 50 days, we have one administration in power. And just because we're going through a transition doesn't mean that we take a break for 50 days. So let's get moving, EPA. We'll work with this administration. We'll work with the next administration. But we've got to get these things out as quickly as we possibly can.
Yeah. Do you put the Biden administration on notice at the same time and make sure that they see the letter?
Well, yes. I mean, it's important. Yeah. And, you know, we're already having conversations, of course, with the transition team. And one of the most important parts of the conversation is the backlog of regulatory actions that are pending, so that the team coming in understands, wow, there's a lot on our plate. These are the deadlines. This is what we need to prioritize. And this is how we move quickly to right the ship and engender some goodwill with this community, with rural America and the biofuel community.
Yeah, I was trying to be optimistic on the RVOs under the Biden administration, Emily, yesterday, and Davis kind of laughed at me when he said that we could be waiting until August or September. Is it going to be that long of a wait?
Well, I hope not. I mean, it's too early to tell. You've got to see kind of, you've got to get the new team in place. But, you know, the point that we will continue to make is that the most important thing coming out of the gate is that we restore integrity to the renewable fuel standard. It's going to be good for rural America, good for biofuel, and it also for an incoming administration with climate goals.
Right.
You are going to continue to decarbonize liquid fuels when you use more biofuels, as you will when you're doing the RFS right.
Yep. I want to get to that in a moment. First thing before that, though, give us an update on the motion that was filed, I believe, was it November 23rd by a coalition of the biofuel and the ag groups? It's a motion asking the courts to enforce a 2017 decision, right?
Yes. Yeah, so we've got a few legal things in the hopper right now. So we filed this fall a motion for summary judgment on our FOIA case, our 2016 FOIA case, which essentially says, we need fairness and transparency. And EPA, if you're going to be making decisions around refinery exemptions, it should be done in public too. So that's one filing that we recently made.
Okay. All right. Very good.
Yeah.
What are your plans or your strategy? Are they changing in anticipation of the Biden administration?
Well, the priorities don't change. So what we need to see in the short and the mid and the long term doesn't change. But how you engage and how we kind of build the case, make the case for the relevance and the critical importance of biofuels changes based on the priorities. So the conversation right now has to be with this incoming team. They have an agenda. They have a Build Back Better program and a rural program. And so it's showing them how, first of all, Mr. Biden made some very strong affirmative statements on the campaign trail about a strong renewable fuel standard, admonishing EPA for its handing out small refinery exemptions. So part of it is reminding that team of what was said and what was committed to, and then showing them, in your first 100 days, these are some easy wins, easy things that you can do. They don't cost any money. It's all within the administrative control on the regulation side. And you're going to engender goodwill with an industry that's critically important for the strength of rural America.
Okay. So when farmers hear, and I'm talking about corn producers, ethanol producers, when they hear that climate change is going to be front and center at every agency within a Biden administration, what should the message be that farmers hear when they hear that from the Biden team?
Well, what the message that we should be delivering to the Biden team is, if you want to be aggressive on carbon, agriculture is the solution. We have made so much progress with our innovation and sustainable agriculture. Let us be a partner and let us be a solution. Don't position us as the problem, because we are part of the solution. That's what we need to be parroting back to the administration to make sure that they understand, because I think there's a lot of education that needs to take place with some of the leadership coming in.
Absolutely. As there always is. That's a never ending battle right there, Emily. Your thoughts when you hear a current California Ag Resources Board, CARB, Chair Mary Nichols' name mentioned as a potential head of EPA. What's your thoughts there?
She's familiar with biofuels, and so it's important for somebody to have a familiarity with biofuels. So certainly it's nice to see that. I mean, if you look at CARB's low-carbon fuel program right now, biofuels are creating more credits than any other source of energy.
Yep.
So You know, most important for us, whoever is going to be coming in, is that we have a constructive relationship, that we take the time to educate them on pressing biofuels policies. So, you know, it's not helpful for us to take a real public position on individual names that are being bandied about. More express, you know, we're committed. We will work with whoever comes in. And if they have a baseline understanding of biofuels, all the better.
Gotcha. What else? What else is going on, Emily, at Growth Energy?
Well, you know, while we're doing a lot to prepare for the transition, you know, we continue to be focused on the commercial build out. And so retailers are excited. They continue to be excited about E15. I've had a lot of conversations with retailers this fall that got the grant money from USDA. So we're working with them to make sure that that grant money, it comes to fruition. Because while we have these bigger climate and policy conversations, we need more retailers every single day to be pumping E15.
Right. Yeah, I noticed some of the retailer conversations that you're having in kind of a short little podcast setting out on Twitter. That's a neat effort that you've got going, Emily.
Well, thank you. It's been really fun because it gives me a chance to kind of connect with them, especially in this time when we're not seeing each other in person. And so to hear what's top of mind, to hear their optimism, even when the fuel market has been so challenging this year, there's still a lot of optimism around the momentum of higher blends and what it can do, you know, how the margin, how financially for the retailers, but their customers love it. And that's right. The great part in these conversations is when I ask them, well, you know, what's the customer feedback? Well, they keep coming and buying it and putting it in their tank because it's a great value product.
Yeah, absolutely. Which reminds me of the comment from John Linder, the president of NCGA, that he made when you and I and John participated in the ethanol town hall meeting here not too long ago, that John and NCGA sees the next ethanol for the corn market could be ethanol and the expanded and increased blend rates out there. I mean, it was such a positive message. And when you look at the potential of the potential under a climate-focused, right or wrong, but climate-focused administration, I got to be excited about the next 4 years of a Biden administration with ethanol.
I'm excited. I'm optimistic. We've got our work cut out for us. So there are some. There are some naysayers out there, of course, and so there are many. But what I've found is what we need to educate the people coming into Washington is how much we've evolved in the past 10 years in ethanol, in terms of ethanol production and sustainable agriculture. And when you sit down, you say, hey, this is the data today. This is what we're able to achieve. They're truly astounded and very impressed. And that's if we can continue to get them to be thinking about today's science, today's marketplace, the demands, then we should be in good shape.
Yeah, excellent. Well, if I don't talk to you before Christmas, Merry Christmas to you and happy holidays. And Emily, thank you so much for making time for us this morning.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Chip.
All right, that is Emily Score. She is the CEO of Growth Energy, one of the biofuels champions that we love to talk to here on AgriTalk. Okay, when we come back, Davis and I will wrap it up.
I'm Andrew McRae, inviting you to join me for Farming the Countryside, a farmer-focused podcast important to agriculture. It is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Visit pivotbio.com to find a representative near you.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Bayer. For a strong start, trust the tried and true protection of Corvus and harness extra herbicides from Bayer.
So, Davis, I was looking at some ethanol issues during the break there, following that conversation with Emily. I wanted to check on a couple of things. The one thing that I was looking for was, because she was talking about how the retailers are saying that when they offer the unleaded 88, the E15 blend, that people are buying it. So the question in my mind was, how many cars out there can use the unleaded 88 or E15? And according to Growth Energy, at the Growth Energy sites, 95% of the vehicles on the road.
Right.
So if you're out there driving right now, more than likely, the vehicle that you are driving can handle E15 or unleaded 88. So remember that when you pull up and see that cheaper price on the E15, that it's probably okay for you to fill up.
Yeah, I'm running on it right now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
I'm not,
I
but,
am too.
You know, my vehicle is. Yeah.
I do know what you mean. She mentioned that 2016 court decision that they are looking for EPA to enforce the court ruling. I recalled it. I went and I looked at it real quick during the break, so I'm not 100% up fresh on it. But remember when they put out the 2016 RVOs, and I believe it was in November of 2016. It would have been under the Obama administration. We lost 500 million gallons of blending. That's when the mantra became 15 billion gallons is 15 billion gallons.
Right.
Because they were chipping away at the RVOs. So, you know, the comment typically has been, well, there weren't as many waivers under the Obama administration as there was under the Trump administration, which is true. So, therefore, we should be looking forward to the Biden administration. It's not like the RFS was shown complete respect under the Obama-Biden administration either. And that is I like the fact that this suit has been filed to require EPA to live up to the 2017 court ruling on this, that those 500 million gallons should have been allocated out there. You know, the effort here is to claw back, but it's also an effort to put it right back out in front of the incoming Biden administration that, hey, pay attention here. We haven't forgotten this.
Right.
Okay.
Right. I like Emily's approach on that. You know, hey, let's not get hung up right now in speculation on, well, who's it going to be? Well, it could be, you know, let's just stay focused on the singular message and keeping that highly visual, you know, let's just keep it right out there so it doesn't get lost in personality and just maintains the standard itself.
Yes. Yeah. Great point. Great point there. The goals of Growth Energy, of ACE, of RFA, of all the biofuel supporters out there, the goals aren't going to change. Some of the strategy might change because there's going to be an administration out there, I believe, that is going to be a willing listener to ideas when it comes to the climate. And then when you look at some of the things that are happening out there, like what's happening in Colorado right now, they are drafting a GHG, greenhouse gas, pollution reduction roadmap. Okay.
Yep.
It's going to use lower carbon fuels. I don't know if it's going to be similar to CARB in California or not, but the use of renewable fuels is a very important piece of the puzzle out in California. It's going to be an important piece of the puzzle in Colorado's pollution reduction roadmap. And these efforts, they should be embraced for a couple of reasons. Okay. Number one, they're going to focus on renewable fuels. Number two, let's make sure that they're using the right information, up-to-date information, accurate information on what biofuels can do for their efforts. They shouldn't underestimate the potential help that they can get in their efforts from biofuels, but they shouldn't overestimate it either, because if they do overestimate it, what's that going to do? It's going to leave them saying, you know what, this wasn't as good a deal as what we thought it was going to be. Well, maybe your expectations were out of whack.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, it's like Emily said, it is an ongoing effort to educate, and they've got to stay active. Can you imagine the task to stay active on the federal level, to stay active on the state level? Because it's each and every state that we're having to that are having to deal with this.
Well, so, and just think about it. I mean, it would be good for reducing, you know, carbon emissions, but it would also look great on paper. I don't know if I'm sure they've thought of this, you know, but just show them, hey, look, and in just, you know, 3 months, we put more E15 out there and made it more widely available to the public. And look at the reduction in the carbon output from, you know, the combustion engine. Look at all the work we've done. Well, guess what? You know, people like Emily Skor and her organization have been doing that work for years now. Exactly. But hey, look, if it looks good on paper for them, you know, whatever it takes, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep. And you know, with the clearing of some of the smog from the cities during the pandemic and the shutdown, you know, people are going to be realizing that, hey, you know what? We don't want that smog to come back. Not in our
town. We need cleaner fuel.
We need lower carbon fuel.
Yep.
There's an opportunity that is coming biofuels way through all of this. That's right. That's right. All right. Hey, thank you for listening this morning. Appreciate it. You got to come back this afternoon. Brian Hoops from Midwest Market Solutions. And tomorrow morning, we've got Jim Minchert from Purdue University and a farmer forum right here on AgriTalk. Sound FM on the radio. Thanks to Acuron Corn Herbicide for sponsoring the AgriTalk podcast. Talk to your retailer about how you can get 5 to 15 more bushels with Acuron. Acuron is a restricted-use pesticide. Acuron Yield Advantage range is based on 2016 Syngenta and University trials.